From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up.
In the race for president, Tuesday was a big night for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, but Arkansas's governor still has big reservations about his party's frontrunner.
Twice as many people as expected are vying to be delegates to the Republican National Convention from Arkansas. We'll talk with the party's chairman.
President Obama names his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, but both of Arkansas's senators say they won't back giving him consideration. Meanwhile, a Democratic challenger is objecting.
Little Rock's mayor gives his annual State of the City.
And the Little Rock Trojans defy expectations in round one of the NCAA tournament.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
And I'm Chris Hickey.
That's coming up on this week's KUAR Weekend Review Podcast. Well, after Tuesday night, it seems like the front runners are becoming a little more clear. We had one Republican now, Marco Rubio, drop out of the race. And Donald Trump seems to be becoming the more inevitable nominee for his party. Though, of course, there are still efforts to challenge him. There's still talk about maybe a brokered convention. But first, Jacob, let's start with you. Tuesday night really did look good for Trump, as well as Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side.
Yeah, Donald Trump's campaign, they were hoping if they'd won in Ohio, which is one of the only places they didn't really win in, that he could cinch up the nomination, make sure that there would be no path for any other delegate. But John Kasich, his only victory, he's the governor of Ohio. He won that state. But Donald Trump, he's still continuing to be the clear front runner. Ted Cruz thinks that he can get Marco Rubio support, perhaps. Marco Rubio dropped out. He didn't even win his home state of Florida. I think he maybe only won one or two counties there, actually. And not much fallout from Arkansas's Republican Party, who most of which had their support for Marco Rubio. I don't know that their input really matters that much, but here's one thing that Jim Dotson, the House Majority Whip, said. He said, a little of the hope, optimism, and light in America just died as the nation descends a little further into division, so he's not too excited about endorsing Donald Trump or Ted Cruz.
And heading into the Republican National Convention, Sarah, you spoke with the chairman of the Arkansas Republican Party, Doyle Webb, and first off, he said there's a lot more interest from Arkansans than normal, that you've got 220 people now who are vying to go, whereas the state will only send 37 delegates. Is he attributing this just to the excitement that this presidential year has brought?
Well, I asked him if he thought that that was because there might be a broker convention or because Arkansas had moved its primary up this year, and he said it was those things and the fact that there are more candidates in the race at this point than usually. He had expected about 100 applications for delegates, and he said the ones that they got were from all types of people, students, you know, homemakers, retired people, just he was saying, you know, it's not just people who are traditionally affiliated with the Republican Party. We're attracting more. And I also asked him, you know, if there is a brokered convention, what will these delegates be doing? What decisions will they be making? Will they strategize together to have one result for the state of Arkansas? What would that actually look like?
Our delegates are bound to vote for the individual that they are committed to on the first ballot. So when the roll is called and Arkansas's votes are cast, there'll be 16 delegates who will vote for Mr. Trump, 15 to vote for Mr. Cruz, and 9 to vote for Mr. Rubio. On the second ballot, those delegates, those 40, could vote any way they choose to do so because they're no longer bound under our party rules.
And is that's the point at which things could shift?
If it does become a contested primary, it would occur because no candidate received 1,237 delegate votes on the first ballot. And when we go to the second ballot, many of the delegates are released throughout the convention. I believe it's close to 60% can then vote for who they choose. That's when it could be interesting at the national convention.
And how actually will the delegates be chosen to represent the state?
Well, there are district-level committees and state-level committees. The applicants will have the chance to give a short speech, and then those committee members will go on the basis of their applications and make the decisions.
Well, meanwhile, Governor Asa Hutchinson, he had been backing Marco Rubio, and he went on NPR about 3 weeks ago and talked with Robert Siegel about his concerns about Donald Trump, and that he felt Rubio was the best person to bring the party together. Obviously, though, with Rubio now out of the race, Sarah, you were there. You engineered this end of the conversation and also spoke with the governor afterward. But at this point, he's not convinced or not ready to back Trump.
Right. When the governor and his aides came into the room, I heard him speculating, sort of sounded remorsefully, that no other candidate other than Trump actually could possibly have enough votes to win the nomination at this point in the first round of the convention. So he also was saying, you know, I don't know why Rubio didn't win Florida. He sounded like he was still kind of grappling with that. But basically, he's not ready to support Trump. He's still expressing the same concerns as before, that not quite as strongly worded, not saying Trump's frightening, but saying that he has a lot to prove still. He wants him to embrace the Republican Party values and show that he can bring together all the different components of the party, the traditional elements like Hutchinson and party leaders, along with the angry voters that Hutchinson says, been, you know, drawing on so far. So Hutchinson had this conversation with NPR All Things Considered host Robert Siegel and seemed to be saying he's looking forward to the possibility of a brokered convention, but he'll support the nominee in the end.
Well, here's that whole segment from All Things Considered Wednesday.
The last time we heard from Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson on the program, it was 2 weeks ago, he had supported the former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee for president. Huckabee was out of the race, and he switched his support to Marco Rubio. Governor Hutchinson, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Senator Rubio has dropped out of the presidential campaign. Where does that leave you?
Well, it leaves me without a candidate right now. I was delighted to support Marco Rubio. He did not do as well as he needed to do in Florida. He made the right decision for the party and for himself by suspending his campaign. So I have three choices, Donald Trump, John Kasich, or Ted Cruz.
Well, where are you leaning?
Well, I'm still watching. I think there's a number of things that I'm interested in. And very importantly, who is the best person to win in November? Secondly, who can bring our party together? And Donald Trump has a lot of momentum after last night, but he has to show that he can unify the party and he can appeal to all elements of the party and win in November.
When we spoke last, though, you raised concerns about Mr. Trump's trade policy, its impact on jobs in Arkansas. You spoke of temperament, circus atmosphere in the primaries, salesmanship in place of serious discussions. Have your concerns about Mr. Trump diminished? Have they grown larger, or have they stayed the same?
Those concerns have not diminished. I have those concerns, but there is an opportunity, and I know that he is trying to demonstrate that he is a presidential character, that he can unify the party. I recognize that you know, my policies and my view of government is probably more accurately reflected by others in the race, but at the same time, I recognize that it's a difficult path to victory for the candidates, and we could go into the convention with none of the candidates having a majority or a sufficient number of delegates.
And in that case, would there be anything wrong with having an open convention and going to a second ballot and having any one of those three or none of those three be nominated?
Well, not only is there nothing wrong with it, but that's what our process is. Now, it will meet with some objections because some people have a view that if you go in there with the plurality of delegates, then you're automatically entitled to the nomination. But that's not what the rules provide. Somehow you've got to convert that 42% or whatever it is, the delegates you have, into a majority, and that's when it gets interesting. And so this process has got to unfold, and I'm going to be watching it carefully.
You have spoken of the need for Mr. Trump to show that he is capable of presidential leadership. Has he shown you that at his recent rallies over the past couple of weeks?
No, I'm concerned. Now, while it's an example of where you learn as you go through this, but certainly Donald Trump had a right to speak at his rallies. The protesters were disruptive, but the question is, how is his response? Does it bring people together? Does it diminish division in our country, or does it increase it? And obviously, we need a president that can lead in that fashion. And not only that, we need someone that can accomplish that goal in November, because if we're going to win in November, whoever our nominee has to have every branch of the party, from the evangelicals to the establishment, from the Tea Party to the traditional Republicans. That's what he's got to show, that he can bring those people together.
Governor Hutchinson, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Great to be with you.
That's Asa Hutchinson, a Republican governor of Arkansas.
The governor on Wednesday's All Things Considered. A few more primaries coming up, and maybe we'll see then whether or not Ted Cruz continues in this. Bernie Sanders still has some very passionate supporters.
Right, and Bernie Sanders, he's been arguing that this remainder, or at least the next month or so, the primary calendar benefits him. There are a lot of Western states with more white voters, which he's done better with, but the delegate counts aren't as high. Some of the states are Arizona, Idaho, Puerto Rico, Utah, Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington. And then the next big one is Wisconsin on April 5th. So there we are.
Well, on Wednesday, we had President Obama announce his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. This, obviously, to replace Antonin Scalia, who died a couple of months back. Jacob, pretty much Republicans have been saying from the beginning, we're not going to consider anyone from this president, that it should be left to the next president. And I'll play my conversations with John Bozeman, as well as his Democratic challenger, Connor Eldridge, here in just a moment. But first, your take on this, pretty much what we expected.
Yeah, it's what we expected. The Republicans said that under no circumstances would they consider any nominee from the Obama administration, saying basically they wouldn't even decide to vet the merits of an individual nominee, this case Merrick Garland, who's been in the D.C. Circuit Court for a number of years. The reason behind this is with Antonin Scalia's exit, the court is widely considered to be evenly split among liberal and conservative lines, and they want to wait, basically the Republicans do, for another president to be elected. They hope, I guess Ted Cruz, maybe. I don't know who they hope. We just tried to figure out who Republicans are backing right now, but they think that they could get a conservative in there if they just wait a little bit longer. No surprise, really. And Tom Cotton, John Bozeman, they both issued statements, but they didn't say anything specifically about this candidate.
Right. No discussion of the
nominee.
The merits of this
nominee. But seven Republican U.S. senators have said they're open to it.
And so, I think it's, is it 14 or 16, something in that ballpark, Republicans would have to get on board for this to go forward. And the Senate obviously is the body that approves Supreme Court nominees. But I spoke with Senator John Bozeman about this, and here's what he had to say.
Well, the president has come forth with a nomination, and we've made it clear that that we're going to stand by the precedent of the last 80 years and really let the people, have a voice in this. We're a divided country, and so I think Republicans feel very strongly that this should be done after the next election. And that does follow the precedent of the last 80 years. If you look at what Senator Schumer said in the past, when you look at what Vice President Biden has said in the past, and President Obama, all of them have agreed with that with various statements in the past.
I've heard some dispute about that, and that people have been named as recently as like 87, I think, and then it was considered in 88 during President Reagan's last term.
I think what happened then, went back to the Bork years. So he was nominated in the previous year. In June of the previous year, it was withdrawn. And then I believe it was Kennedy, was put forward at the end of the year and then carried forward into the next year. So there was, you know, that was a very special situation. But he was actually, you know, it actually occurred the following year.
Do you think this will stand, that indeed the Senate will hold together and not consider the nominee?
No, I think that the Republican senators are going to stand together, and we've talked a lot about this, and we'll be following the precedent that has happened for the last 80 years. This is such a high-stakes situation. The court's divided, as is the country. And so we're talking about lifetime appointments. In fact, historically, come about springtime, maybe just a tiny bit later, Supreme Court judges, not Supreme Court, but just federal judges in general, haven't been considered. It's called the there's a particular name for that particular rule. So when you get into these really high-stakes offices like this, this has been the precedent for many, many years.
But I know your Democratic opponent has been critical, said he this candidate should actually be judged on the merits of his background. Any concern, you know, about politics if it's suggested this is strictly a partisan action?
No, I'm not concerned at all. What we're trying to do is do what the precedent's been in the past. There's a lot of comments by Democrats about various aspects of this that's hasn't been the precedent. I think the Washington Post recently came out and said that was three Pinocchios, and said that these are politically convenient fairy tales, and I would echo that. So no, we're working very, very hard to get our job done, and right now, you know, we're just in a situation where we feel like very strongly that we should follow the precedent of the past, as Senator Schumer and Vice President Biden and President Obama have said in the past. And now that the shoe's on the other foot, though, they simply don't want to do that. They'd like to ram this through and not let the people have an opportunity to have a voice, and my opponent seems to be in that camp.
So obviously, Senator Bozeman wanting this to be a presidential election issue. Meanwhile, his Democratic opponent took this as an opportunity to challenge Senator Bozeman. And this is Democrat Connor Eldridge, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Arkansas.
Well, you know, I think folks in Washington have enough excuses not to do their jobs. And to me, the Constitution provides a guide as to what ought to be done. And the president has nominated, the Senate ought to consider and advise and consent. It's a very simple process laid out in the Constitution. And I'm extremely frustrated that the Senate is refusing to do its job. You know, it's precisely the job of the United States Senate to thoroughly evaluate any nominee by any president, and I'm frankly disappointed that Senator Bozeman is refusing to do that and therefore neglecting his constitutional duty.
Senator Bozeman and other Republicans say there's 80 years of precedent of not considering an appointment during an election year.
That's actually not true. There are six occasions in which nominees were considered in a presidential election year, but that really also just misses the point. I mean, you know, this issue is everything that is wrong with Washington. You know, Washington is completely broken, and that's become a cliche, and it's really a shame. I mean, here, in my view, as I've said from the beginning, leaders of both parties, leaders in the Senate and the president, should sit down, find a judge that's going to be a good judge, and put that judge on the court. And, you know, we have obstruction and a refusal to put politics aside and do the job of a United States senator. We've got a complete refusal to do that. And that's really a contrast in this race. I mean, I'm running to be a strong new voice for Arkansas, to go to work every day to not kick the can down the road like this, and to engage and put politics aside to make good decisions for the future of this state and this country. And this is one of many instances that indicate that's not currently being done.
Do you have an opinion of Judge Garland on the merits in terms of him as a potential nominee?
You know, I think that's why there's a constitutional process for evaluating nominees. And I think, you know, as a U.S. as a U.S. senator, with any nominee by any president, I would thoroughly evaluate that person. I would encourage vetting and hearings and all the things that have taken place, you know, for centuries in our country to evaluate Supreme Court nominees. And so, you know, I would allow all that to take place and evaluate the nominee through that process. But the real issue here is that, unfortunately, Senator Bozeman and others are refusing to do even that, and that is really a travesty.
So Connor Eldridge not discussing what he thinks of the nominee, and as we said, Senator Bozeman also pretty much not weighing in on his thoughts. And the nominee, Judge Garland, is pretty well respected, pretty much considered a mainstream candidate. But Jacob, or any of you, do you think this is an issue that could gain any traction here in Arkansas's Senate race?
I don't know. This is the kind of issue I heard on the Diane Rehm show, at least. All the pundits, they kind of weighed in, and their analysis was that it's kind of the issue that only base voters know about. Your hardcore supporters really know about the dynamics of Supreme Court races like that. I think you're right to point out that this nominee is considered relatively moderate. He's not someone that progressives are super happy about. In the weeks before this, a lot of crazy names were floated. One possible person was the first Hindu nominee. There's a range of liberal judges that a lot of liberals hope that Obama would go for. So it's not the most controversial guy. I think the nominee from the president that's going to matter the most in the U.S. Senate race is Connor Eldridge, who got his U.S. attorney job from President Obama appointing him. So any President Obama nomination, it's going to be that. And Eldridge doesn't like talking about being linked to that.
Yeah, the speculation I've heard is that this makes the Republicans look bad, potentially, because the majority of the populace doesn't appreciate what they're doing. But since they've started it, they can't backtrack. And I wonder if this would contribute to some of even Trump's supporters' feelings about the mainstream Republican leadership, that they are obstructionist and they just can't, you know, let anything happen.
Although maybe the majority of the country feels that way. There aren't any polls about this, but I bet the majority of Arkansans probably agree with the elected representatives that they don't want the president's nominee to be considered. They generally don't like this U.S. Supreme Court. They don't like their decisions on same-sex marriage and things like that. I'm sure they'd prefer Republican.
But often when you do have extreme partisanship, like whenever the government has been shut down at different times over the years, that often ends up working against. It's mainly been Republicans who have done this at different points during Obama's term a couple of years ago. It happened during Bill Clinton's term, and that's often come back to work negatively against the party. So I think mainstream Americans are often turned off by extreme partisan actions, but we are obviously in a different political climate.
It does get in a funny way to the pretense or truth, what have you, that the Supreme Court justices and all justices should be and are nonpartisan.
Right.
Well, this week, closer to home, Chris, we had Little Rock Mayor Mark Stodola give his annual State of the City address. That happened Thursday, and he touted that the city is making progress in reducing crime, improving its economy, providing more information to citizens, and reaching out to underserved areas. So really sounds like he was saying the city is doing well right now.
Yeah, he struck an overall positive note, and this has been the third time I've covered the State of the City address. He usually does focus on some negative areas of the city or city issues that are, you know, have struck a negative tone in the past, but this year he really didn't, he really made a positive kind of address. And regarding crime, for instance, he said that the city has made strides, and he cited statistics over the years that the city has had to deliver to the FBI. And here he is talking about that.
Annually, I want you to know that we report to the FBI all Part 1 offenses that occur, and which I would like to call the Big 8. We report 4 violent crimes, murder, rape, robbery, and assault, and 4 property crimes, burglary, larceny, vehicle theft, and arson. I am happy to announce that this year we have submitted to the FBI as Part 1 offenses the lowest number of occurrences that we have had in 15 years. By comparison, in 2003, we reported 21,341 Part 1 offenses. In this past year, we are reporting 15,699 offenses. This represents a 26% reduction in the number of Part 1 offenses reported to the FBI. It represents a 4.7% reduction from our previous year, 2014. And in 2014, we recognized a 5.8% reduction from the previous year. I'm pleased to say that while we certainly experience hot spots of violence that get widely reported, last year we reported a 30% reduction in the number of homicides in our city, a 30% reduction. It's very difficult for our police department to anticipate where somebody may use violence and use a gun. And I will tell you that the prevention efforts that we use in a multiple different ways, I hope, are helping to continue to drive these numbers down like I just reported.
And he also credited, you know, the city's police chief, Kenton Buckner, who's been in the job for about 2 years, with instituting more community policing practices. And there's a report out this week by the newspaper, the Democrat Gazette, showing that the instances of force has been down over the past 4 years used by the police department. And, you know, he also kind of talked about how the city and the police department has been making an effort to hire more Spanish-speaking officers and officers in the community housing and neighborhood programs department. They've been trying to hire more Spanish-speaking employees as well. And he credited City Director Joan Adcock, who has spearheaded a group called Working Together in the Community, with reaching out to the Latino community in Southwest Little Rock. And he announced a bit of news that's come out of that, with discussions from there, which is that the city is likely to begin a program of issuing municipal IDs to residents who don't have them. So that may be a development that we could look forward to coming up. He also briefly addressed the kind of contentious issue of the Interstate 30 expansion through Little Rock and North Little Rock from 6 lanes to 10. And here's what he had to say about that.
Now on the horizon for the future is a resolution of the I-30 crossing project and its impact on our downtown. It is a decision of great importance, one which will impact the city for the next 50-plus years. It is a decision of monumental importance, and I would like the public to know that I, along with our city board of directors and our staff, are all working very hard to find a plan that will allow the city to continue to grow and prosper and connect our various neighborhoods in unique and uplifting ways. I continue to remain optimistic that such a goal can be accomplished.
So he's a little vague in terms of how exactly, you know, they'd be addressing those plans by the Highway and Transportation Department, although the mayor does sit on the Metro Plan Board of Directors, which has some bit of authority in approving or disapproving the I-30 expansion plan, you know, which that will come for a vote before them probably in the next few months. That I-30 expansion is slated to begin, construction is slated to begin in 2017. There's currently an environmental assessment going on right now. He also addressed a recent initiative by the city to make more of its data available to the public online. And it's kind of a resource for people to look at, you know, statistics on 311 calls, you know, crime statistics and other city services. And
just this week, the Board of Directors approved a resolution of intent that will move us forward on the open data project with significant impact. Through the What Works Cities initiative, sponsored by Bloomberg Philanthropies, we are partnering with several national organizations to make this a reality. We are learning from the best tech organizations in the world. We are organizing our data into sets, creating a governance team, taking a strategic approach to getting the information out to all of our citizens to use. And this open data will open doors for all of us. Our citizens will be empowered to not just find, but also to use publishable data that is freely provided by the city of Little Rock.
So there you have it. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, regarding the economy, he said, he noted that, you know, the city's unemployment rate is much lower than the state of Arkansas's. It's at 4.3%. He praised kind of the investment that's happened along the Main Street corridor last year, over $100 million in private investment, combined with some state and local grants, or state and federal grants. And he mentioned, you know, the expansion of a few companies in Little Rock and things like that. So, yeah, overall, pretty positive. He didn't mention, like he did last year, the state control of the Little Rock School District. Last year, he had kind of called for the local control to be returned, but no mention of schools, no mention of, you know, some other issues with, like, student discipline like he kind of emphasized last year.
Well, finally, we had a big night Thursday night. You know, we often point out at the end of the podcast that we are an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. But we couldn't help but be excited to see the game. It was a nail-biter, double overtime. Trojans were not expected to do well in this at all. It was pretty well conceded that they did great just to get to the NCAA tournament, but they managed to upset fifth seed Purdue, 85-83.
All right, I'm going to try to take us through this game, although I was hosting All Things Considered during much of the game, so running back and forth between reading the news on the radio and checking the TV in the next room. But yeah, like, people didn't really expect the Trojans to do that well. It was great that they made it. They had a record-breaking for school record, at least for season number of wins, 29 wins in the season, beating a record they had in 1988-1989 season. The team's only been to the NCAA tournament, which is like the college basketball championship, five times prior. The Trojans had, depending on what you looked at, between like 11 and 15% chance of advancing against Purdue. They were the 12th ranked seed in their division for this tournament. Purdue was 5th ranked. But let's just hear the end of the game, the buzzer beater. The announcers were excited, and they talked about a little bit about the coach, Chris Beard, who's in his first year as a coach, although he's had great success at smaller schools in the past.
Yeah, this is from the national broadcast from TBS.
TBS.
He missed it. Edwards at the buzzer. No good! And in double overtime, Little Rock is moving on. Chris Beard's Trojans were down 13 with 3 minutes and 19 seconds to go. And in double overtime, Little Rock, with his 30th win of the season, another 12-5 upset, the second of the day after Yale defeated Baylor. And Little Rock will now see Iowa State on Saturday.
You got to give Chris Beard an unbelievable amount of credit. They changed the whole game plan with about 6 minutes to go. Instead of packing it in, pressuring guys, and you know what else? They were playing a one-man zone sometimes when guys couldn't shoot. This was a real chess match, and Chris Beard did one heck of a job.
So a lot of good things to say about the coach, Chris Beard. We saw Joel Anderson, the chancellor, on the sideline on TBS.
A few times.
He was sitting on the side, too. But a lot of credit also goes, of course, to the players, the people who had a lot to do with winning the game. In particular, people are excited about Josh Hagans. He's a guard. He scored 31 points on the night, which is a lot of points for a college basketball player. And he tied the game up with a three-pointer with about 5 seconds left to send them to the first of two overtimes. This isn't that shot, but it is him in overtime hitting a dramatic shot, and it's a good example of sports announcers. We don't hear him a lot on public radio.
Hagans has had the hot hand. Hagans, step back, jump ball! Oh, Josh Hagans taking over! We call that in New York, he's going off.
So there he goes, a New York sports announcer. But shot to tie the game to get an overtime is from 30 feet out, which is, Chris has played basketball a little bit with me before, pretty far out. That's like 8 or 9 feet beyond the three-point line, almost at half court.
So, I have this Harry King.
Yeah, Harry King, the well-respected, longtime veteran sports reporter for Arkansas News Bureau. What did he tell you?
I've been talking to him for the last few weeks as the Trojans have been changing expectations or upending expectations. And he said, okay, you know, it's really great they got to the NCAA, but they're not going to beat Purdue. Purdue is in the top 10, and they have multiple players who are really tall, and they're going to be NBA players, and there's just no way.
All I know about them is they've got two big kids, one of them 7 feet and the other one 7'2". They play in one of the better leagues in the country. The Big Ten is, other than the Big 12, is probably the best conference. They were third during the regular season in their conference, and then got to the finals of the conference tournament, which is a difficult thing to do. I know they're going to be good. I know Little Rock will compete. I know they'll play good defense. My concern would be, can they match up inside? Are they going to get killed on the rebounding, and Purdue wind up putting back four, five, or six baskets, which they missed?
So the now moves on to Iowa State Saturday for the second round.
The second round, yep.
And we'll see what happens. But this may be the only time our podcast listeners hear us do a sports report on here.
The Trojans haven't done this since 1986, advanced to the next round, and I wanted to play a little, since we're having fun with the Trojans, listen to what broadcasters then were like. Their music was a little bit different than now.
That is the end of the game. The final score, Arkansas Little Rock 90, Notre Dame 83. We'll return for some closing
fun
comments on
music.
Tonight's game after these messages.
Kind of 1980s style of sports music. Well, with that, we record the podcast here on Friday afternoon, so we'll find out how Little Rock does facing Iowa State on Saturday in the second round. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah White-Sakotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
If you're not a subscriber, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Thanks for listening.